I've been getting some kind of interesting questions over the last month or so.
I thought I would put some things together for you, because you've all been listening for a long time, and so you have a lot of knowledge and understanding, but sometimes the reason that you're gaining all of this knowledge can get lost. So then it becomes more intellectual and removed from the very reason that you ever came to gain it in the first place. And I think when I'm teaching for a long time on understanding different things, understanding Ishwara, understanding Maya, the Panchakoshas, all of these things, you know, that are important things to understand, after some time, we can forget why we're understanding all of these things. Yeah. So I want to remind us why we're understanding these things, what the purpose of it is. You come to a teaching because things aren't okay. Things are not only not okay, the universe is such that they can't become okay. In other words, we've all had moments of happiness, and up to a certain point in your maturity, just as a jiva, as a person, as a human being, up to a certain point, you can be excited about those moments of happiness because you know that's what you're looking for. Or that moments of feeling love or feeling loved, that depth of love. You feel happy when you have those experiences because you know it exists. That you can love, that you can be loved, that you can be happy. So everybody has those experiences. But those experiences are always bound by sorrow. They're because they're time-bound experiences. And why I say bound by sorrow is that if the experience of love or being loved goes away, that is a sorrowful event. Right? It's only if the experience of love or being loved or being whole stays that all is well. But the instant that feeling of being loved, of that connectedness with God, or connected when you feel loved inside, you feel connected with God, you feel connected with the universe, everything is meaningful and makes sense. And then it's a loss when that goes away, even when it goes away to a neutral position. Because we don't necessarily just want to be neutral. We want to feel whole and complete. And those words all revolve around being loved, feeling loved. We want to be loved and to love. That's a completed whole condition, to feel loved and feeling loved to love. And we would like the state of feeling loved to last, to not always be in jeopardy. This maintain ourselves, maintain carefully the state of being loved or being happy or being whole. And that's what every samsari does. Doesn't matter if you're a samsari here on this plane of existence or on any plane of existence. If the state of happiness is something that is momentary, then you're trying to stretch that out and make it last as much as possible. And at some time you realize that state of well-being is always momentary, and it will always be momentary as long as it's dependent upon things that are momentary. Right? Which is the whole creation. Everything that we experience, including the body and the mind, it's everything. And so then you wonder, is there any wholeness or happiness that is free from that? Is there any way that I can really be happy? Because you even start to notice that happiness has underneath it a sorrow. The sorrow that you of knowing that happiness is going to come to an end. Even the sorrow of loving your child or loving your partner. There's a happiness in the love, but there's a sorrow in the fragility of the love. You know? And so we start, even as one becomes a little sensitive, you start being aware of the sorrow behind the happiness. So it's a sorrowful happiness. And so at some point you become a mumukshu, means a seeker, somebody who kind of looks up to God and says, is there is there any way out of this? Because you've recognized that your whole experience of happiness is based upon temporary phenomena, which is your mind and your sense organs and your body and other people and the whole planet. There's nothing stable. And so that turns you into a seeker. Is there anything that's free of this about me? You know, that's what we want to discover. It's free of it, and it doesn't need to be protected. Free of it means it doesn't need to be protected. Free from all of the opposites. So that's what we seek. And the whole vision of Vedanta, the teaching methodology of Vedanta, is to take you to the recognition of that innermost self that you are. To reveal that in relationship to the body and the mind and the sense organs initially. To realize that, first of all, to get you there to that differentiation of just yourself, the conscious being that you are. But it doesn't stop there. So I'm a conscious being. What does this conscious being have to do with the experience of being loved? Everything we talk about, even in terms of Ishwara, in terms of the Lord, in terms of the creation, in terms of all of our relationships, in terms of this teaching, it all revolves around, can I be someone who is just simply loved without having to worry about it? So the question then is not just differentiating the conscious being that I am from the body, mind, sense organs, but now it comes to understanding and recognizing both the nature of myself, the wholeness, which is intrinsic nature of just myself, the me, and recognizing and understanding the dynamics of the experience of happiness, the experience of joy, the experience of sorrow. All of these experiences that go on in the mind, what are the dynamics? What's the cause? What's the cause of the mind's experience of happiness, and what is the cause of the mind's experience of sorrow? We have to painstakingly go through these causes, because if I don't understand what's causing the happiness in the mind and the sorrow in the mind, then I'm still bound by the same ignorance. And so what I have to come to understand through teaching and through all the different methodologies that we go through, one of them in reference to just the wholeness or the love that I experience in life, is simply caused that the mind experiences. I'm talking about these loving experiences that come and go. We need to understand experientially and logically to the point that there is no doubt about it whatsoever, that the love, experience of love that we have is truly not being caused by anything external. We have to know that. And that's hard to know. It's hard to know because the universe is so tricky. Bhagavan's universe, you know, keeps us all running. Keeps us all running after objects. And it keeps us running after objects in the form of, I need this to be happy. I have to get away from this so that I can be happy. I need this, and if I could have this, I would be happy. This illusion is kept going because it works. If I have a desire for an object and I fulfill that desire, then I become happy. And so if I don't give that phenomena any thought, I will just go on addictively fulfilling desires so that I can become happy. That's how I become happy, is by fulfilling the desires. And not thinking about it, then obviously when I get this thing that I want, this thing makes me happy. That's how we're programmed. And then I get this thing that I desire, and then this thing makes me happy. So the happiness gets totally projected onto these objects. But with just a little bit of teaching, you can see through that. You can see through the illusion that happiness or your experience of happiness has anything, or your experience of love has anything to do with the world. If it did, if some object itself contained love, then everybody would be happy whenever that object was around. If some object contained sorrow, then everybody would be sorrowful when the object is around. If an object, your special object, contained happiness meant just for you, not anybody else, it's your special object, your special object of desire, that object contained happiness just for you, then that special object would continue to give you happiness. But what we notice is every object, not just most, every single object, without exception, every single desire, without exception, not some or most, all of them, can and do, if it's a fulfilled desire, they all do give moments of happiness. Moments. That means that the object gives you a moment of happiness, the object remaining, the moment goes away. See what I mean? The object that you say is giving you happiness remains, right? And you're no longer happy. So you have an experience of happiness that you project onto the object, you know, that doesn't belong on the object. The object has nothing to do with the experience of happiness other than tricking you into having a desireless mind. That's all it does. It tricks you into having a desireless mind. Because when you fulfill that object of desire, at that moment, your mind has no desire. Right? Why? Because you just fulfilled the desire and you have to give it a few more seconds before it can come up with the next one. Right? So in that moment of seconds or minutes, the mind is just abiding. Happily abiding, because I wanted this and I got it. So it's quiet, it's desireless, and in that quietude, that moment, those few moments between desires or searching, you know, my mind has a little samadhi experience, so we don't really call it that. But actually, that's what it is. The mind is just happy. It's just resolved. It's just fulfilled. You know? And so I experience bliss or joy. So what is actually happening then, what is the true dynamic, is that having nothing to do with the object, it's when my mind, with or without an object, is quiet, is relaxed, is silent, is free from desire, you know, in the sense of being fulfilled. Free from the desire in the sense of being fulfilled. Like when you fulfill a desire, it's not like, oh, I don't have any more desires. No, it's complete. So it's silent. Right? And in that state of mind, yourself has reflects off of that vritti, manifests in that vritti, in that thought modification, in a way that we label as happiness or joy or bliss. And so the vritti, the thought modification, is responsible for the variety of manifestations of bliss or joy or wholeness. But all of those manifestations are caused by a mind that is relaxed. a mind that feels all is well with me, like whenever you fulfill a desire. Okay. And so this needs to be, the logic of it and the experiential reality of it needs to be understood. It needs to be taught from many, many different ways to be proven. We need to prove it. You know? It needs to be proven to your mind. You know? And if you start thinking about this, you can prove it to yourself over and over and over again. Like for instance, when you're meditating and your mind becomes quiet, when you're taking a walk in the park on a beautiful day, you know, whenever the mind is at peace, all is well. One yogi, a disciple of Ramana Maharshi, when Swamiji was visiting that ashram, and unfortunately he didn't get a chance to meet Ramana. Ramana had just passed away. But Swamiji was visiting the ashram, and there was a famous, well-respected Swami there who was a disciple of Ramana's, who used to just sit quietly in satsang and never say anything. You know, and, but he's very kind of loving guy. And Swamiji went to talk to him, and he said, you know, what can I do to find peace, to gain that peace? What can I do? And the Swami said, don't do anything. That's what you do. Don't do anything. We're so busy doing the ananda that you seek is your being. The wholeness that you seek is already here. The problem is this ignorance, self-ignorance, causes me to project that wholeness that I experience out onto the world and then run after it. And then when I get the object, my mind relaxes, and then it's in that relaxed condition, it feels whole. So we want our minds. There's a couple of levels here that we're, a couple of levels of understanding, both of which are very important. First of all, just like we prefer to have a healthy body, we want a mind that is healthy. And by healthy, I mean it's comfortable with itself. It feels whole. It feels at home with itself. It feels loved. It feels cared for. It just kind of abides there. And it does its activity and gets engaged in this and that and does this and that. But it's not concerned with its wholeness. We want that. It's not that people want to walk around blissed out all the time. I don't think that people are really seeking that. But they are seeking that feeling of take-it-for-granted lovedness. A taking for granted wholeness that is not, you don't have to worry about. Now, for the mind to achieve that on its own, I'm talking about vrittis now, for the mind to achieve that, it has to find a locus of wholeness that is not going to escape. That's not going to go away. If it finds that, then it can relax. If it doesn't find that, it can't really relax because it'll always be knowing that it's going to go away. Just by the nature of things. That's what makes you a mumukshu. Just by the nature of things, you know it's going to go away. And you want something that won't go away. So the mind needs to find that won't go away. And what it has to find is that which it truly is seeking, which is that secure, stable well-being that cannot be improved upon. And it cannot be improved upon means you recognize it and then say, yeah, but, oh, if I could just make it like this. There we are. Then we're back in samsara. So it's the recognition of that which we really do seek, which is something we don't want to improve upon. Which by its, with the very nature of it, we don't want it to change at all. We just want it to be as is. And that's the nature of the self. That self has to be discovered. The mind has to discover that I, this self, is what I seek. And that I, that this self, is the one and only source of any experience of Ananda that the mind ever has. That whether I fall madly in love with somebody, the source of the Ananda is that self. Whether I'm loving my child, the source of Ananda is that self. Whether I'm having a good time with friends, the source of Ananda is myself. Whether I'm having a vision of God, of the Lord, of Krishna, the source of Ananda is myself. There aren't two sources of Ananda. Just like there's not two sources of being, there's not two sources of Ananda. There's only one source of Ananda. And that source of Ananda is my own being. And that Ananda reflects in a variety of different ways in a relaxed mind. That's why you can have relaxed, more relaxed, quiet, more quiet, and have the experience from the standpoint of the mind are deeper depths of love, the experience of love, because the mind's more quiet. And you can have shades of nuances in the experience of love, the depth of the experience, the quality of the experience, whether it's more compassion or more joyous or more happiness or more fun, or just all kinds of nuances, but all of them require that relaxed mind. And the nuances are caused by the little reflections in that relaxed mind. And so we can say, if you think that the identification is with the vritti and the mind and the experience of the source of the happiness, then you can say, now I'm increasing the happiness. And I can increase it more and more and more and more. Now you're having the happiness be a mental experience. And this is why, in this teaching, we have to differentiate between this reflected experience in the mind that has to do with the vritti and me, the self, the one that is present to this relaxed mind. So Vedanta is not just giving you a happy mind. It does give you a happy mind. It does. Because the mind, it becomes fulfilled. It's this mind that has the problems, the mind that's creating so much pain for itself, or has, through upbringing and whatnot, and traumatic childhood, and God knows what, so many terrible things have happened in life to create, a painful mind. And so that painful mind, it doesn't want to be in pain. Just like if I have a painful body, I want it to be healed. And if I have a mind that's carrying pain, I want to be released from that pain. And so yes, Vedanta is very, very instrumental in allowing that mind to be completely released from pain. And but that is not really liberation. Liberation is the recognizing of me, the self, that is always released from pain. To recognize, just to say that you have self-knowledge, if you say, I have self-knowledge, my mind is never in pain. If you think that that is self-knowledge, then you don't have self-knowledge. You don't at all. You've missed the whole thing. Because to have self-knowledge is not for you to say that your mind is never in pain or that your mind is always happy. It's not to do with your mind. It's to recognize yourself that is always the same whether your mind is in pain or whether your mind is happy. To recognize that self and the wholeness of that being, the wholeness of the being that you are, that wholeness, that ananda that is your own being is always present to that mind that is happy or in pain. That's liberation. And then recognizing that self that isn't a vritti, isn't a thought modification, isn't a happy thought, or isn't a string of happy thoughts. It's the constant being that you are. That needs to be recognized. And the mind needs to recognize it, needs to differentiate itself from myself. And then when it does that, it has now found the source of wholeness and happiness that it has sought in the world. Let me have this, let me have that. It recognizes the source. And recognizing the source, it also becomes happy. But that is a secondary product. It's great, it's wonderful. But that's not liberation. That's one of the results of liberation. But liberation is the recognition, the actual recognition of the me, your own self, as changeless and whole, no matter what the thoughts are. And then recognizing that, the mind is freed. Now it has somebody that's not going to go away. A whole person, a whole being that is full and complete, that's not going to run away, you know, when the mind is thinking this or thinking that. Even if the mind is in sorrow because of having not worked through something in the world or whatever, its feelings of sorrow, that sorrow is held by the self, who's not in sorrow. And that is a huge relaxation for the mind. So now once the mind knows this, understands it, knows it, then that mind has knowledge. And it can still have a lot of baggage from the past that it is working through. Hurts and sorrows and patterns of behaving in the world that are painful. You know, lack of vairagya, also lack of dispassion. And so the mind continues to go on for some time, you know, being upset, causing pain, working through unconscious problems, bringing all of that. But once having to work through all of that. But once a person has knowledge, then you can be with that and do what is needed, you know, to help all of those psychological problems resolve themselves, to work on your attitude in reference to dealings in the world, because you have a self. And once you have a self, just like Swamiji's book, for instance, The Value of Values, once you have a self, yourself, this book, Value of Values, it's invaluable, because he gives you in that book a value for the values. Why be kind? Why give to others? Why practice all of these, you know, sadhanas? You know, why develop titiksha, the ability to let things go? You know, to accept the opposites that the world has to give. Why develop all of these? Because for your mind to enjoy the fruits of this knowledge, it has to let this stuff go. Right? Unkindness. If you're unkind to another person, then you immediately suffer the results of that. Because in a way, you're unkind to yourself. Right? Unkindness is unkindness. Both people get hit by it. It's not just if you are unkind to another person, unkindness has taken place for both of you. So both of you reap the results of it. That's dharma. That's how it is. And so what you start to realize is that no unkindness is worth it. No selfishness is worth it. It's not worth it because it disturbs my mind. And what do I get out of it? If really, as a samsari, I really believe that my happiness is out there, then it's very hard not to be, you know, selfish or greedy or all of these negative things that cause us pain. But when I know that the ananda that I seek is myself, then it's not to my advantage on just a practical level to pursue this type of behavior. Whatever it may be, to feel victimized or to feel hurt or to feel all of these things, that I want this person to treat me like that or this person to treat me like that. All these things cause us pain. It's not worth it. And so even though we find ourselves falling into those patterns, we choose to look at them from a vantage point of knowledge. Right? So that the mind, we pull the mind back and keep breaking those behaviors. Why do we pull the mind back? Because it's behaving as though it doesn't know myself. It's behaving ignorantly. And so we can remind it. That's what sadhana is all about. But all during this process of reminding, we have myself, the one who's not getting hurt, right? The one who's not being unkind, the one who is always the same. Right? And that allows the mind to freely pursue its growth. So that's one little section. I'm doing a little bit more here. There's a lot in this teaching around the jiva's relationship with Ishvara. Who is Ishvara? And who is the jiva, this individual in Ishvara? So that I am not, the jiva is not here as a limited individual having to make your way through a concrete, insentient universe. Because if that's how you see it, then you may know that I am ananda, that I am the source of what I seek. But boy, I have to take care of myself in this insentient world. Because I don't recognize that this body, mind, sense organs is part of the whole. It's literally part of the warp and woof of the whole. And that karma's brought me into this creation, sustain me, and take me out. Right? Birth after birth after birth. You know? And that this body, mind, sense organs is not alone, but is rather part of Ishvara. And so there's a surrender. The more I understand clearly, there's a surrender of this body, mind, sense organs, and this life to the whole, which means that allows me to be interested in this life, be interested in my experiences. It doesn't stop you from, it doesn't mean that you sit back and quit, but that's not Ishvara, that's not Ishvara. Your life is a very dynamic, active life. It is your life, and it's being unfolded, right? But what is actually unfolding here is Ishvara. And so as you understand this body, mind, sense organs as being part of this room, part of Berkeley, part of the California, part of the United States, part of the creation, you know, you can, in a sense, start to let go of your grip a little bit and be more interested in the life you've been given, you know, and much more interested in Ishvara. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita says, the greatest devotee, Bhagavan says, my greatest devotee is the jnani, is the one who has self-knowledge. Because that's the one who has self-knowledge is the one who loves Ishvara. You know, to think that a Vedantin, you know, is just an intellectual is such a misunderstanding. It's such a misunderstanding of this knowledge. This whole knowledge, the whole thing is just about love. It's about devotion. There's no difference between knowledge and love, or knowledge and devotion, because what you're having knowledge of is the Lord, it's Ishvara. So the more you know, the more you are totally related to Ishvara. From the standpoint of your being, you are Ishvara. From the standpoint of the self, you are Ishvara. From the standpoint of the body and the mind, you are part of Ishvara. Always appreciating Ishvara. You're not, there's nothing else to appreciate. Every experience that you have is Ishvara. So there's never a time that you're not experiencing Ishvara. And there's never a time that your mind is not with Ishvara. Either from the standpoint of the jiva to Ishvara to the whole, or from the standpoint of the jiva, the body, mind, sense organs, to the self. The self is Ishvara. There's only one self. And so the very being that illumines this mind is God. You know, that is when the human being is really only seeking, you can say seeking being loved. Another way of saying that, the human being is seeking union with God. Completion, wholeness, going back home. And so this union with God is really the recognition of that identity. In fact, there is only God. There's only God. The mind then resolves into that truth, totally relaxes into that truth. So to think the relationship of the mind with that self, which is God, which is the self of God, Brahman, right, is dry. And it's absurd. There's nothing dry about love or about wholeness. And so, really, the Upanishads are just bringing you home. Bringing you home through knowledge. There's no other way to bring you home. Because you're already home. So where can we go? Everywhere you go is not it. Everywhere you travel is not it. Unless you recognize that everywhere you go and everywhere you travel is it. That's what you have to realize. That there's no going. But you can't realize that by going. You can only realize that by knowledge. You can't realize it through meditation. People think this is so blasphemous. Meditation is to say. Meditation is wonderful. Meditative experiences are fine. They're wonderful. There's nothing wrong with them. But they're especially wonderful for a jnani, because you know what it is. But they're not very nice for an ajnani, because they can't become an experience that you're seeking. They're not a resolution. Meditation does not resolve into your being. It resolves into an experience of the mind, which you are left high and dry with it when it goes away, to have to try to get that great experience back. You know, for jnani, it isn't like that. You can have a nirvikalpa samadhi experience or not have one. It makes no difference. It's not that it's not wonderful. You can have all types of meditative experiences. Those are fine. They're not knowledge. You have that meditative experience in knowledge. Or, as a jnani, somebody who's working to understand, you meditate on yourself so that your mind can, you know, slowly break this, what we call dehatma buddhi, this identification with the body. Give the mind a chance to just be with yourself, to just get to know you as you are. Give your mind time to do that, so that as it matures, as it understands, then there's never a time that it doesn't know you. It's because you're never not there. But the mind has to know you differentiated from it. That adhyasa, that superimposition, it's got to be broken down. And as it breaks down so that you recognize you as you, then, you know, we learn ways to work with our mind to help our mind grow. We learn how to be patient with it. Just like you, I really like the example of learning how to, just like you would, how you would raise a little child. How patient you have to be. How loving you have to be. How caring you have to be. That same attitude you have to give to yourself and give to your others. That's the great sadhana, really, is the way you treat your own mind. I think that if you can have that ahimsa, that non-injury, and that maitreyi, friendship, that loving friendship toward your own mind, then the rest of the world will benefit. Not only will your mind feel so grateful that there's somebody who has that. You know what that maitreyi is? It's a love. It's a friendship. You know. It's just the mind is so grateful for it. So then, when problems come up, when you have, problems or doubts, or your mind is unhappy or going through whatever it has to go through as it kind of works through. It's got to work through a lot of stuff. So it gets knowledge. When you get knowledge, self-knowledge, your mind still has to work through whatever is there. Knowledge helps a lot. It gets rid of immediately, so to speak, so many of the fundamental problems that have caused a lot of pain to the mind. But then there's a lot of maturing and there's a lot of unconscious work that has to be done. So once I know myself as the source of love, if I can gain that maitreyi toward my own mind, that's the great sadhana in terms of efficiency. Efficiency is important, right? We like to do things that work and that are effective and that don't waste time. This is the most effective. Gaining knowledge through the shravana and manana and nididhyasana, you know. But then the value of values. The value of values, Swamiji's book. But what is the value of values really is ahimsa, non-injury, or maitreyi. Those two, if you put those two together, you really understand. Those two together are beautiful. And that, if you turn it toward your own mind, then things start to change. There's a lot more to be said about this, but I think it's kind of important to bring this home so we realize what we're doing. And it is an ongoing sadhana also. I'd like you to listen into Swamiji's first tape, you know, that you've probably already listened to it, but now I've transcribed it. And so if you listen to it now with the transcription, it's online. So you can bring and just listen through it. That first one, I'm going to work on the third one this weekend, I hope. But that first one is very profound. I would go over that, listen to it and read along and just go over line by line by line. He covers some things that makes it so clear in reference to how to be with this knowledge, how to hold this knowledge. You learn from and see clearly, I am the whole. But then here you are having to negotiate in the world. So when your mind acts up in the world because you get engaged, then you have to bring your knowledge in. And that just becomes habitual. because you're getting sucked in, you're getting engaged and then behaving in a way, your mind's be acting up and behaving like an ajnani. It's what we call pratibandhika jnanam. Knowledge with obstructions, that's what this tape is about. Your mind's just behaving like an ajnani, it's all right. You just go in and bring your knowledge to bear. And the mind appreciates that it's being rescued. Just go in and rescue it, you know? And so developing that Maitreya that will go in and just rescue the mind with the knowledge is an ongoing. Ongoing means at any time that the mind does that, then you help it. And it doesn't matter also whether it's internal, inner child type problems or external habitual ways of reacting that cause you pain. If they cause you pain, something wrong there. So you need to go in and rescue it. Talk to that part of yourself and try to understand what's going on that's causing the pain. You know, the person who has knowledge, if you know yourself, you have the freedom to do that. Because yourself isn't going to be changing on you. Since you're not changing, you can go and help those things that are. Right? Since your being's not changing, you don't have to worry about that. And you can help the parts that are in trouble. So I hope you listen to it. It's very beautiful. It's worthwhile. So let's take a couple minutes.
After somebody gains self-knowledge, that the problems of the mind actually get louder.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think what happens is once you gain knowledge, start seeing, it's a huge relief, and it almost put you in a exalted state for a while because the mind is so shocked, and so it seems so experiential when you start seeing, the mind can feel just. But then there's a level, it pushes it into, it's kind of a level of relaxation also, and that causes all kinds of torrents of unconscious stuff to come up. So everybody experiences it, everybody talks about it, you know, it's like torrents can come up depending upon, you know, what's there. But yeah, so it can kind of rock the boat in a way. Is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the best thing is, if you realize that, to be kind of happy and to just be with that and let those things come out, you know, and know that there's just a lot of release taking place. And not to think it's a bad thing. It's a really good thing, actually. But you have to... You have to just let it kind of come and go. If you're in therapy, talk to your therapist or talk to your teacher about it. But basically, it's to appreciate it and let all of that stuff pour out. It's a good thing. And I remember I started looking forward to the next layer as it would come. In the next layer of problems that would present themselves, because it's just such a relief, you know. And I used to wonder, well, wow, is this bucket ever going to reach the bottom of the well? But you do reach the bottom of the well, you really do. It's not that there aren't always in the unconscious going to be, you know, things to work with. But I mean, in terms of things that are really problematic for you, you reach the bottom of the well. I remember when I got kind of close to the bottom, I was thinking, gee, I think there's only one or two more things. And it was true. It was true. There's only one or two more things, and those things finally went. And it was a big relief. That doesn't mean that you're just totally mature and you don't have problems anymore. But I mean, in terms of all kinds of, you know, painful stuff having to deal with. At least that was helpful for me.
that
problem. I used to look forward to that.
How long did it take to get to the bottom of the bucket?
It took a few years. Yeah. Everybody's bucket's a little different. But that's, let me explain that. I would say maybe, for me, maybe a couple of years, two or three years of, you know, just stuff coming out like layers. But, you know, in the process of becoming a mature, loving person whose mind is just basically at peace. That's the, you know, that's an ongoing process. And I still find my mind continues to become more beautiful and more loving. Just like all of you, you notice your mind matures. Now, I don't know when the end of that is. Maybe there's no end to that. There is an end to the recognition of yourself as Brahman, your being. My being, as it is right now, will always be just what it is right now. That's not maturing. Brahman is not maturing. We're changing. So once you know yourself, you know yourself. That's it. But in terms of, you know, understanding all of the intricacies of Ishwara, also all of the connections, so I think those connections that you make are limitless and always creative. Like even when I listen now, I was really listening carefully to Swamiji when I was back at the ashram, and I hadn't really listened for a while. I notice how the different things he's bringing in, the different things that he's noticing is important now. It's just ongoing creativity, even though, you know, the understanding of Ishwara certainly is there, the understanding of Mithya is there, of Maya is there, that's not going to increase or decrease. But then all of the intricacies of the relationships, how to handle people, how to handle yourself, how to be with people, how to be helpful, how to teach well, that's endless, you know? And I think the wisdom, the wisdom that a person gains is endless. Not the knowledge of yourself or Maya or Mithya, but the relative knowledge of being a human being in the world and interacting with other people. Just goes on and on. And that's it. That's a wonderful thing. Is that? It's lucky that the self can't be improved upon. Because I think that your mind, your relative knowledge, your mind, your body, all of these things are subject to endless improvement. You know, and so there's no liberation in that. Yourself isn't subject to endless improvement. You are. Yeah. And then you can enjoy this endless improvement or the ups and downs and whatever, you know. You can enjoy it. But if you think that you have to become something, there's no way off the conveyor belt. You know. It can always be better. So if we're seeking that, it's a... You can always be better. You can always make more money. You can always get a higher, a better job. You can always improve somehow. And so, you know, that's samsara. So if that's what we're looking for, then you haven't really realized the problem. You know, then that mumukshutvam needs, that vairagya needs some maturation. And that keeps maturing also. You know, all those qualities, you know, vimanitvam and dambitvam, all of these, all the, like the viveka and the vairagya and all that, those keep maturing. They resolve in knowledge. Like the vairagya, the dispassion, that totally resolves into sannyasa, into knowledge. You know, and so you notice that resolution taking place in yourself as you mature. And until then, you take care of the little child who needs some help inside. It's not a big deal.
But I'll ask anyway. You said when the mind acts out, we should bring knowledge to it. But it's so easy when the mind is acting out to sit there and witness it, and still the mind acts out. Like, I'm not sure how to integrate that peace while it's acting out.
Well, sometimes you can't do it when it's acting out because it's acting out.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But afterwards, or when you're by yourself, you can rerun that, you know, and you can talk to that part of yourself. I think that's the most helpful. Say your mind is just acted out. You're in it, right? So you're already in it, so you're probably going to go all the way through, chances are. But afterwards, you know, you can talk to that part of yourself. You can kind of see what you'll feel badly about what happened. But instead of punishing yourself, you can talk to that part and find out what happened from that part's position. It's usually something, child is in there, you know. Find out, let that part talk. And then you can give it some love and guidance. And that, in that way, it can grow. That acting out part can grow. And that's a way of bringing your knowledge to it. Right? But you have to bring your knowledge to the... You can't give a lecture, a Vedantic unfoldment. to a three-year-old. You have to take care of the different parts, you know. And they change, really. Everything changes with love. That's... You know, the bottom line, really, is, you know, what changes you is love. And once you found the source of love, then as your own being, once you understand that relationship between the self and the mind, you found the source of love, then you can give that love, the part of your mind that has that Maitreyi that you've learned for that friendship, can give that love to the parts that are very hurt and wounded. And we all have those parts, unless you've brought them up. You have them until you've taken care of them. And taking care of them requires love and patience and understanding all the things that they didn't get. Right? Yeah. We have to give it.
You know, it's kind of tricky sometimes, you know, because like it's there's a part that comes in that needs to fix things. Yeah. It's the thing that needs to be fixed, you know.
Yeah, I know.
and it looks like I'm being patient and loving, but really, it needs to be fixed. Yeah.
When you notice that one that needs to fix, you can talk to that part and say, you know, maybe the best way to fix this, is just to simply, you know, try to listen and understand and be patient. That's the way to fix it. So you have to tell that part that wants to fix it. You have to train it into how to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Men, that was really valuable for me because I'm a really little misfix-it.
Well, I think it comes because of the Western psychology, you know, to talk about your problem, fix it.
Well, I think part of the fixing, though, in psychology, mm-hmm. what really heals in psychology, say with a client, for instance, is to be able to really listen and totally understand, really listen and be there, present, and understand the problem. That goes a long ways to fixing it, is to be able to listen and understand it.
Yes, that definitely is my experience with you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's my experience too with my teacher and with my therapist and in life generally. It's very, very healing to be understood.
You come out of the shame also, right? So,
I remember it. I don't remember exactly what it is, but I remember telling Swamiji something I'd been carrying. I was scared to death to tell him some horrible thing. I told him, I don't know, maybe it was that I smoked or something. So I smoked for a couple of years when I was young, from about 15 to 22 or something. I think I told him. Maybe that was, anyway, it was something. And I was horrified to tell him whatever it was. And he knew that I was trying to tell him this thing. And finally I told him. And he was shocked. He said something like, is that what it was? He said, yeah. And he laughed. He couldn't believe that was what it was, that it was such a nothing. And actually, once I said it, I couldn't believe that it was, that's what it was either. I've been carrying this stupid, I don't think it was smoking, I don't remember, but it was something else, because that's not, I don't think that would do it to me. It was something I was ashamed of. But just that it was truly nothing to him. It was nothing. You can't fake that. I mean, it was truly nothing. And then he was interested why that would have been a problem to me, you know. And the whole thing just went away. It's like I lost this huge load I'd been carrying. And I think in therapy that happens all of the time with your clients, because finally they unload something and really it is nothing. Nobody cares. You know? It's not at all what you think it is. But it's just a huge release when you let it go. But you can only let it go into a situation where you trust. I don't know, I'm not saying everything I want to say about this, but it's not coming out quite how I want it to, but you get the idea. And I think fixing works. You can the fix it, the misfix it can be effective once you've really listened and understood. If you've done your time listening and understanding, then the fixing it is always in reference to the real problem. You see what I mean?
Yeah, because of the understanding.
Yeah, then you know what to fix.
Right, but the fixing I'm talking about, and I think Penny is pointing at too, is the fixing that, like, to use the spiritual and the psychological for approval or something like that.
But...
Yeah, that's it for approval.
Well, I know, but how would you deal with that internally if that's what it is? If it's for, then there's somebody inside who really needs it to be approved, who really needs approval. I mean, a lot of our child parts are like that. They just really, really want to be told how wonderful they are and that you're just a beautiful, darling child. I mean, really for a little child, they should be told that. A little child should be the object of the parent's devoted focus and love. And really, you see parents like that with their child. If you go to visit a parent with their children, you're all just staring at the child. But that's good for that child. That's a beautiful thing, right?
Yeah. That, to me, it's like, that's what that looks like.
Yeah.
I see what they're talking about.
Yeah. And the child is just, you know, absorbing that like crazy. But some of us didn't get that in full measure. Most of us didn't. You know, and so now, though, we can go and get that internally. You can be present to those parts that didn't get the attention and need to be told that they're good and beautiful and, you know, and need to be approved of. So I don't think the adult us need to be really approved of. I don't think that's the adult talking. I mean, everybody... That's not completely true. Everybody wants it on just a practical level, on a human level. We want to be mirrored and approved of. That's normal. but that kind of deep longing inside that we'll go out of our way to do things just so we can get a little approval because we feel hurt inside. That's what I'm talking about. The Kohut, who's one of my favorite psychologists, says, you know, that positive mirroring is like oxygen to the soul, really. Yeah. So it's not that we outgrow a need, you know, to be loved by and to have, you know, positive relationship. It's human.
Well, Swamiji explains it so beautifully. He says, you know, what kind of a God is it that doesn't accommodate you? You know, the judge, you know, the God is judgmental, you know. Because then you're already at the core poison, so there's no more possibility for you ever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're born in sin, you know?
Yeah, if you look at God as a critical, judgmental God, then you're being contained in criticism.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That which gives meaning to everything is critical and judgmental. So that's a sad situation to be in. Well, should we call it a night?